Committee, let's start off with a bill introduction vote, so I'll go into work session.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3550, dated 2/21/17, be introduced as a committee bill, and I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves 3550 be introduced. LC 3550 be introduced as a committee bill. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to once again reiterate for individuals in regard to this LC and other LCs that these do not reflect the opinions or positions of any member of the committee, and they're simply introduced for discussion, and in many cases some of these never go anyplace, and in many cases they are amended. And so the introduction is simply a placekeeper for discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so done. I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 181, and we will go through our agenda today in order. I'll open up a public hearing on 181 and a work session, I should say. And so we have a Kyle to give us a briefing.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 181, the committee heard this, the original had the public hearing on 2/14, so this is a continuation of the discussion. Just as a reminder, Senate Bill 181 is relating to an information return. It's a requirement, or would put in place a new requirement, an annual information return related to properties that are seeking exemption under ORS 307-130. That's the Literary, Charitable, and Scientific Organizations exemption. And what I have up in OLIS is actually a document. There was some discussion of the public hearing on the 14th, so I've compiled some of that discussion, and then what's also been submitted to me as well as potential changes to the bill. So I figured we can walk through that a little bit and then use that as the starting for the discussion. But so that's under the media materials under the SB 181. We do have that on the screen. Okay, so the way I set it up is the table you see just starting off is the information return contents. So I just wanted to list those. This is an introduced version, so this is what's in the version right now. And there's really two categories you can put them into. You have the organization reporting and then the property-specific reporting. So starting with the columns there on the left, this would be the requirements and information return at an organizational level. So the first one, and these are based upon the way the statute and the common law is set up today. So it would be more or less asking for questions to be answered that are already used under the current qualification standards. So the first one would be a response, and the responses are limited to 100 words or less. So this would come into the assessor annually, and it'd be submitted by the property owner. But the first one is the basis for the organization's claim to have charity as its primary object. And then go on to manner in which the organization performs in furtherance of its charitable object, and then the ways in which the performance involves gift or giving, which that is a requirement today under existing law, and the quantification of that gift or giving as a percentage of the organization's total expenses as reported on IRS Form 990. So one of the things that this committee has heard about over the last couple of sessions, and probably even further, was the interest assessors have in having bright lines for setting qualification standards. So that's one of the reasons that is included there in the gift or giving as a percentage of the expenses on the 990 return. The 990 return, that's publicly available, but that's set by the IRS, kind of the standards and what's required to go in there. So that would be in something from which really to establish at this point an idea of what's out there even. So if information returns required, it would become more available what is the gift or giving that's out there today. And the second part is in the property-specific reporting. It goes more to how the property is being used. First one, how is it being exclusively used by the organization, ways in which the property is substantially contributing to this charitable acts, and then the number of days in the previous property tax year it's been used in unrelated way. So there can be, under existing law, there is some allowance for using the property in ways unrelated to the charitable act if it's more or less a minimal use. So if it's occasionally used in some other way, that's okay, but this would be trying to actually put it out there. What are the number of days? Is it 2-3 days a year or 40-50 days a year? Again, just in one of those things that could be helpful for a possible bright line. And then moving down is the potential changes. So these were ones that were discussed at the public hearing, and then also a little bit of feedback that I received from the Department of Revenue as well, a couple technical things. But the first one, and this was just the general topic of confidentiality, there's some discussion on these returns. The way the introduced version is written right now, these returns would be confidential with some specified ways in which the assessor could share that information with other state agencies and Legislative Revenue Office. But there was discussion on whether or not even to keep the confidentiality or to somehow make it more workable, I suppose, for the assessors. It's important to note that disclosure of this would be a Class C felony. That was brought up as well. The timing of the required forms. So again, there was testimony on the way the introduced version is written right now. The 990 form is a requirement, along with the Department of Justice CT-12 form would have to come in as well. The way it's written is it could be asking for a form that actually hasn't been submitted yet, because there would be a delay. So there might be a need to look back maybe a year or two to get the most recent form that should be submitted to accompany the information return coming into Oregon. A grace period, that was brought up as there could be a need for a grace period if there are legitimate mistakes in filing your form or something gets lost in the mail or something to that effect. So there is example in statute where if a property owner doesn't get their paperwork in on time or something to that effect, they can then submit a late application for exemption with a late fee. So there is some existing statute out there that could be used. And then a couple of technical things. These came in from Department of Revenue, is just eliminating the requirement for DOR to prescribe by the forms by rule. So you could just leave it in statute, and that would eliminate the need for them to actually have to go through a rulemaking process to make the forms. They would still design the forms, but you could just require in statute. That's almost a duplicate requirement in some ways. And then eliminating the reference to postcards. So in some ways, the reference to postcard, and I've gotten a number of questions on this as well, is there's an e-postcard for the 990 return at the IRS level for the smaller nonprofits. So it's just more or less 8 or 9 lines rather than the full form, which can, in some cases, be up to over 100 pages, if not longer. So that reference to a postcard was really lining up with the IRS e-postcard language they were using, but it seems to have caused a bit of confusion if that would be a literal postcard that would have to be mailed in. So that's a suggestion as well.
So there's quite a bit of work to consider to add to this. Senators Riley or Buckquist, you're on this work group.
I have a couple questions.
Senator Buckquist.
Going down to, I don't, first I'm trying to think, all these are workable issues. I mean, it's basically an informational return, and we certainly don't want to put, you know, and I don't know who you'd put in, it's state, you know, Class C felony to who, the guy who signed the form, the corporation, the nonprofit. But anyway, I think most of these can be worked through and simplified. But I do have a couple of questions. I mean, under the bill, Kyle introduced a version of the Class C felony is the first question. What do we do elsewhere in filing? If somebody files an intentional false form, I mean, Class C felony seems a little bit high for property tax. So what do we do elsewhere in law, do you know? Or do we do anything elsewhere in law?
Yeah, for, Senator, this does actually come from existing. This is, you'd see this on the personal income tax side. And this is for if the information return was non-disclosable and then it's disclosed in this case, it could be like the assessor or and this does come from existing law, so it is a Class C felony. It's one of those things, even on the property tax side, the central assessment information that comes on the central assessment return or the industrial returns that come into the Department of Revenue, those are covered by non-disclosure statutes, and it is a Class C felony to disclose those. So it was really just using existing language to put it in there. But as was brought up during the public hearing, most of the information, the 990 returns, and a lot of that information is already publicly available. It would really be the answer to the question specific in the information return would be the new information that may or may not be available already today. I mean, in a lot of cases, this is probably the same language that's out there on the nonprofit's website, that when saying explain how your organization is performing in furtherance of its charitable object, it's probably going to be potentially a copy and paste from existing information that's already out there.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And then, I mean, the timing reforms, obviously, yes. I mean, in most other tax reforms, I'm assuming we have statutes elsewhere that if a corporation, entity, or individual delays their filing, you know, the requirement then kicks down the road. And I would think, you know, pretty simple fix for timing is your most recently filed, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's ways to fix that is go down there. I mean, I really don't see anything insurmountable on here. And the postcard, just for clarification, Mr. Chair, and restating the committee, yeah, as Kyle said, is that, you know, smaller entities don't have to file the whole 990 form and the variety of the 990 form, saying simply if they make less than X or Y, then they file a smaller form that goes along there. I mean, the intent here is to close the information loop. And if we can do that without, quote, causing undue harshness on any entity, and all the material already exists, I don't know how that's harsh, but it seems to me that all these can be worked through. We just need to send the signal that we're going to do it, and that way everybody else comes out of the woodwork and says, okay, yeah, these are the other areas we need to fix. Because without this information, I don't know how we go forward. I really don't. Senator Riley, and we've been at this 18 months now, and what we don't have is any information.
Senator Riley?
Yeah, that's. I was just going to say that's exactly right. It's really, as he said, 18 months, and what we've done is basically determined that we have a bigger problem than we thought we had.
Oh, imagine that.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'd also point out that, I mean, I would suggest, this is just empirical data or subjective, that, you know, probably 90-95% of the nonprofits out there, you know, are completely legitimate and so on and so forth. But we know from the court cases that there are some that are not, some that there have been problems for. And this really actually helps, despite what the Association of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon might think, this actually helps them ensure that there's clarity and that their legitimate members are all covered, and that the bad apples are much easier for us to find, which then it's much easier for us to make reforms in the tax code to take care of the bad apples. And so I'm still supportive, and I think there are House members that worked on this, of coming up with some sort of system that is amicable to all, that we simply share existing data and existing requirements.
Douglas Schmidt, did you want to weigh in on this again?
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and it was just, I wanted to thank the committee for keeping this in front of them. And I wanted to thank Senator Riley and Senator Boquist for working on this over these last months.
Years, Doug.
Years, okay. Well, yes, we've been dealing with it for years, too. And even though this doesn't provide a clear, bright line right now, I believe it's a good first step in gathering information on how to hopefully identify some type of a clear, bright line that the nonprofits, the charitable organizations that are doing the work get the exemption. And I appreciate the committee's work on this, and what you have suggested for changes. It clears up some of the problems that we had. If on the felony part of it, the disclosure by assessors, part of it was we didn't know in the information that was being gathered what was confidential, because like Kyle said, a lot of it was already out there, and I think that was the issue, was not the fact that we're gathering the information, but it wasn't clear if there was a specific piece of data that was coming in that was should be confidential, because a lot of it is already out there. But I appreciate the committee's work on this, and hopefully in the next several years we will gather the information and be able to identify some criteria.
Okay, questions? Thank you. Thanks for your engagement on this and your help.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest is there other people? You have more to testify.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Thanks.
Chuck Sheketoff and Jody Weiser.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Shakatoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We're actually in the middle of an appeal to the at the magistrate court level of our property tax exemption in Multnomah County. And so I can speak to this from some personal experience. I don't think this solves even a fraction of the problem. When we applied, when we moved to Multnomah County and we applied for our exemption, we submitted a whole bunch of information, as we were advised to on the application. We then get a form letter back saying, send us more to show us that you meet the criteria. We did that. We are denied without any reason cited. And so this doesn't address that. So then we went to the magistrate court and we filed a complaint, as you do, and the response showed that they hadn't even read the file. And when we had the first hearing with the conference call with the magistrate setting up a schedule for the briefing, it was clear they hadn't even read it. And the issue isn't them getting the information. I don't think that's a problem of any nonprofit not willing to put in the information or the assessors not knowing what to ask for. The issue is clarifying what the standard is. So the standard that is being used is a whole slew of magistrate cases, and I would urge you all to read them. And so there's one what I would call a pretty bad case, although it may be fit the one the nonprofit in existence. But they, for instance, in our case, are relying on that to say that my office doesn't put out information, it puts out ideology, whatever the heck that is. And they also, the cases, I think they need clarity in the law of how do you prove charity if you have membership? And if you don't have membership, my organization's not a membership organization. And so I've been reading all these cases where the assessors keep losing. And I go, you know, the attorneys are just taking them and doing them. It seems like, frankly, because a lot of them are environmental groups, small environmental groups. And there's talk in the environmental world, frankly, that it's like the assessors are going after all of them. When I've contacted them for copies of their briefs and for perspective on the issues. And so I don't think this solves the problem. They can ask for information. The nonprofits can provide it. They know what's confidential and what isn't and what can be. I mean, the issue is getting clarity, getting that bright line, saying that if there's a membership group that's and defining what is a charitable purpose or a research purpose or whatnot, an educational purpose. So I just don't think this does it. I think there's a problem with sort of these wholesale denials, and it doesn't put pressure on the assessors to have to specifically state their reasons for the denial instead of just denied. So when you get to the magistrate court level, you have no idea when you're filing your complaint whether, you know, you have good reason to file the complaint, whether there was a good reason to deny you. So I would urge you to, I recognize a lot of work's been done on this. I'm sorry I missed the prior public hearing on it. And I'd be happy to work with your work group, but I think a lot of work needs to be done because I think the assessors are doing these sort of wholesale blind denials that are problematic for the nonprofit community.
Senator Riley, do you have a question for Chuck Shakatoff?
No, I just wanted to say I think Senator Boquist and I probably agree that this is not the solution, and we're not posing it as the solution. What we believe, and at least I believe, is that we aren't getting enough information to create that bright line yet, and this is a step in getting that information.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley, I would just suggest you have the information to help create the bright line by reading a bunch of the cases, frankly, and you'll see how the magistrate court has rejected a whole bunch of assessor denials. And I think you also, when you talk to the nonprofits, you'll say, oh, maybe one of the things we ought to do is put some burden on the assessor to have to state the reason for the denial and with clarity, with all the clarity that you want here and all the details you want here. So I think you have the information in front of you.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with your original presentation at all, and I've read the cases. And the problem is I think as you recognize, as you move to Multnomah County, is there's 36 different systems, plus Department of Revenue. So it's 37 different systems, and when you go to the case law, it becomes very, very problematic to try and figure out what's going on. So we have some assessors that do exactly what you have just outlined, Multnomah County, obviously. And then you have, which I don't believe is an elected assessor, so maybe you should recall the county commissioners. And then you have elected county commissioners who are fearful, and they do a bright line, or they do tell people because they don't want to be recalled. And so the challenge is trying to create, don't disagree with anything you said, is a system that works in 36 different counties with 36 separate governments plus the Department of Revenue. And we would welcome your input into our work group and your participation.
And so
absolutely.
It's a nightmare.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Buckwith, I'd be happy to participate. I think the issue on the bright line, I understand the difference in process between elected and non-elected and whatnot, but I think, and who might cite answers back or whatnot, but I think the more important issue is being a little more clear about the test based on the decisions that have happened, and maybe a second look at whether or not you can, assessors should be relying on an IRS assessment, which happens every year when the 990s are put in. You know, if a nonprofit 501c3 charitable organization is prohibited from partisan activities, any candidate election, whether it's partisan or not. So if they lose that, they would obviously lose their property tax. They're prohibited from spending more than an insubstantial part of their budget on lobbying, which is not just the legislature, but it's also in Oregon, initiatives and referrals are considered lobbying under IRS rules because they're the legislature in that situation. And there's prohibitions of grassroots lobbying versus direct lobbying. I'm doing direct lobbying right now. Grassroots lobbying is when you're sort of getting the masses to do something, non-members. And so, you know, I'd be happy to work with you on getting a little more clarity so that not only is the process better, but more importantly, the line is brighter.
Jody.
Good morning. Jody Weiser, testifying for Tax Fairness Oregon. So although I've run a number of nonprofits, I've never done it with an office. And it's always been from people's homes. And so I've never dealt with property taxes. I don't have any of Chuck's experience. And our current 501c, C3 is a C4, a political organization, not a C3. It looks to me like you're dealing with enough different situations that you probably are getting good information in some counties and not in others. And that's what's part of what's hindering it. And we like the idea and certainly would be happy to fill out more than the postcard that we currently fill out if we were getting a benefit like paying no property taxes. It seems like it's a direction you need to go. Thank you for doing it.
Senator Buckwith?
What?
Okay. thank you.
You can
thank
take you. Over the workman.
Thank
work
you.
Work in progress. We can close the public hearing and work session on that and move to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 174. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 174 is another one of the tax credits, is the research and development tax credit. So to refresh everybody's memory, the tax credit is for a portion of research expenses that occur in Oregon. There's a base amount that's set by, there's a calculation for that. And the main tax credit is 5% of those expenses that exceed that base amount. The credit does have a 5-year carry forward. It's non-refundable. It's largely tied to the federal research tax credit, so all of the definitions are in federal law. There is an alternate calculation that is the credit would equal 5% of the amount of expenses that exceed 10% of Oregon sales. The credit is capped at $1 million per year. The majority of the vast majority of the credit is taken under that primary calculation. We do have all the paperwork in OLIS, and there is a document entitled Qualified Research Activities Tax Credit, and that is the pages from the tax credit report, just pulled out and limited to just this tax credit.
And the revenue impact?
The the cost of the credit right now is between $15 to $20 million a year. Because of carry forwards, the cost of extending the tax credit would be $5 million in the 17-19 biennium. This is a tax credit where every year $70 to $80 million is claimed on tax returns, and only about $15 to $20 million is actually used to offset liability. So there's a large carry forward piece. So that's why the discrepancy between the annual kind of current impact and the cost of extending the tax credit. Because even if the credit were allowed to sunset, a lot of those carry forward would still affect revenue for a few years.
Okay. Questions of Chris? All right. We have a few people signed up to testify against this. John Calhoun, Chuck Checkatoff, Jody Weiser.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun, and I'm a resident of Portland. I'm here today speaking against SB 174. I recently retired from a career in the tech industry. I started with Intel in 1972 when it was a small company. Over the next decade, the semiconductor industry was targeted by Japan, and Intel was eventually forced out of the memory chip business. One of the tools that Japan used to give it a competitive edge was subsidized low-cost capital, enabling Japanese semiconductor companies to build plants at a lower cost than American companies. The Semiconductor Industry Association argued for the creation of the federal R&D tax credit that was passed in 1981 as a means to counter the Japanese. I know this because I was Intel's representative on the SIA Public Policy Committee at the time. In 1983 and 1984, I served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Science and Electronics at the International Trade Administration at the U.S. Department of Commerce. And I continued to lobby within the government for continuation of the federal R&D tax credit as part of the American trade policy in our trade war with Japan. But a lot has happened since then. Companies like Intel, Apple, and Microsoft now earn billions in profits and are not short of capital. Well, much of the R&D done by U.S. high-tech companies remains here in the U.S. Much of the manufacturing is done overseas. Plants that used to cost tens or hundreds of millions now cost billions. The R&D tax credit is simply no longer a factor in providing the necessary capital for the industry or keeping industry employment here in the U.S. The Oregon R&D tax credit is even more ridiculous. The total tax credit benefit offered by the state is only $15 to $18 million per year, while the industry spends $6 billion per year on R&D in Oregon. Do you honestly think that a credit of less than 0.3%, not 3%, 0.3% changes any behavior? The Oregon tax credit accomplishes nothing. After I left Intel in 91, I spent the next 25 years working for startups. For true startups, the tax credit is not helpful because most of the businesses lose money in the initial years as they're developing their products, and therefore they pay no income taxes. Once they become profitable, the tax credit is still not a factor in their business planning or R&D expenditures. The tax credit is an afterthought of the tax accountants. As a CFO of one of these smaller companies, I was usually minded by the tax accountant that when we started making money that we should begin reporting our R&D expenses. In no company where I was a CFO or investor, and I was an investor in a lot, did the Oregon R&D tax credit factor into any management decision on R&D, nor did it provide any meaningful funds to assist our business. Frankly, the Oregon R&D tax credit is the purest example I can think of where there is a tax expenditure which is a total waste of state resources, provides no quantifiable benefit to the state. A similar expenditure at one of our state research universities or Business Oregon might provide more benefit to the state and, frankly, to the industry. Those who tell you otherwise are simply going through the motions of protecting an unnecessary subsidy. At a time when we're facing a $1.6 billion deficit and you're going to have to make some truly painful cuts, this should be one of your easiest decisions. Do not renew this tax expenditure. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Chuck Sheketoff of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I also am here in opposition to this, to extending the sunset, and agree with Mr. Calhoun. It may be the most prime example of a wasteful spending through the tax code. So it funds spending above a base. It gives you a 5% tax credit, which is not an incentive to do something you weren't already planning to do. For years, I think they may be out of the golf ball business. I used to say, why should I be subsidizing Nike's decision to research new dimples on the Tiger Woods golf ball? I don't think I have to do that. They research and development is a part of the DNA of these businesses. In 2015, on April 2nd, the House Revenue Committee held a hearing on House Bill 2752, which purportedly was supposed to expand the credit and make it better for startups. It didn't really do that as it was written, but that was the purpose of the hearing. The first question after the panel testified was from Vice Chair Representative Cliff Bentz, and he said, why does this R&D credit make your presence here more productive than it might otherwise be? And I need specifics because we've got to measure back why we're doing this. There was a pregnant pause from the panel. And then the head of the tax department for Tektronix, who, as you all know, I think, was the grandparent of our high-tech industry and the first star in the universe there, said the following. I think that's a tough question, in all honesty. I mean, would Tektronix be doing anything different in its business if it did not have a credit on its books? I would say no. I'll be on record saying that. The bill obviously didn't move from committee after that because he was honest about it. So here's my example for you. I imagine everyone on the dais today gives money to nonprofits at some point during the year. And I also imagine that none of you are planning today to give my organization a $100 contribution or a $1,000 contribution. And I also am willing to bet if I offered you $5 back on that $100 or $50 back on that $1,000, you're not taking out your wallet or your checkbook. It's just not an incentive. 5% is not an incentive. Does that mean you should make it bigger? No, because these, again, it gets to the issue of who are the, as Mr. Calhoun testified, who are the companies using this? It's at the heart of their business. They have to do research and development to stay ahead of their competition, to create new products, to deal with problems. So, and I think this is a tax credit that's been over the years raised and not and lowered, gone back and forth on the amount that can happen. I think you ought to end it. There won't be any negative impact on Oregon's economy. Thank you.
What about the just devil's advocate here, both of you? The argument that, at least for startups, this is the difference that Oregon could provide to compete with the same incentives provided in California or Washington or other countries?
This is where I said if you gave the same amount of money to Business Oregon, I think you'd get a bigger bang for the economic buck. For real startups that are developing new products, they don't pay taxes because they're losing money. That is all investment at that time. By the time they convert to making money, it's a different deal. Now, your own statistics, and I'm looking at the qualified research activities report that staff provided, says that half of the credits are less than $25,000. It's just not going to motivate anybody. But 80% of them go to companies that are earning more than $10 million. This is money going to people who don't need it and is not going to the companies that you are concerned about.
Mr. Chairman, and I would just add that, you know, if there's a need to get money into the startups, I would, you know, tax credits are incredibly efficient as far as, but the problem with that is they also don't have the accountability. And so if there's an interest in supporting research and development in startups, fund a program at Business Oregon, give them sideboards, make sure they're evaluating and reporting back on whether it's working, and collecting the data they need to collect on whether it's working. I think that this one clearly fails, you know, what the legal test of but for the causation, but for this tax credit, would this activity work? But I think you could set up a program in Business Oregon where they would have to make some assessment that but for this subsidy that they're giving a startup, the startup wouldn't get going or wouldn't be able to succeed, and run the program that way. This committee is, and your counterparts on the House side, I think, well know that a lot of people think tax credits are the solution to every social and business ill in our society, and they're clearly not. And this is an example of one that isn't.
Good, Chair House. One of the companies I worked for survived for a decade on, in addition to investor money, but small business grants, research grants. That was targeted precisely the way Mr. Shekhodov directed it. And that helped that company survive and eventually produced good products and became profitable, and we sold it and made a bunch of money. But an R&D tax credit during that period of time would have been contributed nothing.
Senator Taylor, did you have a question?
I was actually going to ask the same question that you asked before, but Senator Hassel, I'm good with that. But I was just wondering if staff could tell us, I'm trying to understand, how did this come to be? Do we have any information of how we, if something that must be missing? I didn't know if you happen to know.
Or is it still clear back to
the center? It was created in 1989, mm-hmm. And a number of states do have the tax credit, mm-hmm. or some version of the tax credit.
I'm just wondering if there's something wrong with the initial design that needs to be changed, or is there, I just didn't understand how it came to be, but that's okay.
Okay, no further questions?
Is there more testimony?
No, that's it.
Thank you.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I'm not in favor of giving money to Business Oregon instead, because they can't even track the jobs we're supposed to create now. So, but
okay, that's on the record. Thank you. Well, we're going to hold off on both of these bills. Both of them have subsequent referrals to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, so more work may be needed. I'm going to close the public hearing and work session on 174 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 145.
This one.
Senate Bill 145 is the tax credit for reservation zones. It repeals the sunset date for that tax credit. All right. And you do have the paperwork, the fiscal and the revenue tax statements. Okay, we heard this last, what was it, the 21st? Before? Something like that, yeah. So I think that's ready to move to the committee, Senator Boquist.
As is. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 145 to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 145 to the Joint Tax Credit Committee without recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Just to the point, I'm fine with the bill, but until we hear what our House colleagues say, and
right.
We put it on the matrix.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. 145 goes to the Joint Tax Credit Committee. And I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 468. Kyle.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 468, we do have a dash one amendment. It's up there in Ullis as well, and that's what we have the paperwork for. I'll go through the revenue impact, and that'll actually lead into explaining what the dash one amendment does. But so the revenue impact, so SB 468, just to remind the committee, is making a few changes to an existing property tax exemption that worked through this committee in the 2016 session under Senate Bill 1565. But it's a permissive property tax exemption for qualified industrial improvements. Without going into the whole framework of the existing one, it is permissive with some specifications in there, but there's leeway for the counties and the cities to set up the program how they see fit within the existing boundaries and statute. The changes in SB 468, a number of them are just clarifications, aren't making any real substantive changes. There are two changes that would rise to more than clarification changes, and those are the ones that are detailed in the revenue impact statement. The first one is in regards to brownfields and industrial property that would qualify as being placed on the brownfield. So the first change in 468 is it's allowing the remaining costs of the associated brownfield cleanup to be included in the cost of initial investment for qualifying for the property tax exemption. So the way it's set up in statute is it's a minimum $1 million investment in industrial property improvements to meet the threshold to receive the exemption. Now the county or the city could adjust that upward if they'd like to. But if you're placing the improvements on a brownfield area, you would get to include the cleanup costs of the brownfield in reaching that $1 million threshold for qualification, but the exemption is still on the property itself. So the cleanup costs aren't going to be exempt. They just help you reach that $1 million threshold. Now the dash one, what it does is it changes the language slightly to ensure that it's the cost of the cleanups going forward. So the way it was in the introduced version, it appeared that you could use the cleanup costs going back 5, 10 years or however long to reach that. So this would be the cost of the cleanup going forward is what you can include to reach that $1 million minimum amount. So that's number one. Number two is the changes to the definition of rural area. And the substantive change is including an area located in an unincorporated territory. There's a visual in the meeting materials that just gives you a map that probably better illustrates what that change is. But I just titled it Unincorporated Territory Maps, and it's displaying, get it up on the screen there, but it's displaying, right now rural area is located outside of a urban growth boundary of a city of 40,000 or more in population. So what you're seeing up there is, that's the UGB of the Portland metro area. If you scroll down to the second page, and I think this gets whitewashed out a bit, so maybe it's just easier, the Salem-Keizer might be the easier one to see. But within the red line up there, you see that's the UGB of the Salem-Keizer area. The gray area is unincorporated territory, with the exception of the northern area. That's actually the city of Keizer. This is the city of Salem map. But you can see in East Salem, that gray area that's within the red line, that would be area that under current law is not a rural area, wouldn't qualify today, would qualify under the changes in the bill.
Well, why did we do that change? Help me out on the rural area clarification.
Initially, the change in the rural area was, I believe that was actually included in when the bill moved over to the House, and it was to ensure that it really was a rural incentive, property tax incentive for rural areas, not necessarily in some of the more urban areas. I believe that was the original change in Senate Bill 1565 when it was moving through.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, some part of it is just clarifying the UGB language that was maybe a little ambiguous in the way the bill moved through. So part of that is the clarification, and that's the actual substantive change is making it that area within a UGB that's outside of the city limits would also qualify as the rural.
Questions of Kyle? Senator Boquist, are you happy with the amendment?
Chairman Hass, I'm happy with the amendment. The intent here is to provide an option for the counties, and it also ensures that the majority, more than the majority, the mass majority of the local districts agree. I think Commissioner Cameron brought up a good point of some of the areas that we're trying to create economic development in, up in the San Ym Canyon and stuff. And just as a reminder, colleagues, what we did last session is try to create something between the gain share and all of that at $25 million and above, mostly technical fixes that are in here that go across the board. My only reluctance is the House last time stripped much of it apart, so we'll see what happens if it crosses this chamber to the House and see what they do. So I'm fine with the bill as is. I'm certain that the House will have different interpretations as they usually do, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Are we in a work session?
We are in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one into SB 468.
Senator Boquist moves the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 468. Discussion? Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 468 with the dash one to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 468 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Boquist?
No.
Objections? Going once. See no objections. Senate Bill 468 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate.
Yes, sir.
Senator Boquist will be the carrier. Okay. Paul? Anything else? Okay. We made it through this agenda. And our work is done for the day. We are adjourned.
Okay.
The day. We are adjourned.
Okay.
Cut. It's done for